Good morning. Today, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces conducts the first hearing of the September 2008 term of court. This is a consolidated hearing on three actions involving a pending court-martial, United States against Woodrick. The first case is a defense appeal of a decision by the Court of Criminal Appeals. The second is a defense petition for extraordinary relief. And the third is a petition for extraordinary relief by CBS Broadcasting. Each party will have 20 minutes for oral argument, and the parties will proceed in the following order: defense, CBS, and the government. The defense as appellant petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. CBS as petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge, may please the court. My name is Lieutenant Kathleen Cadlick, and I, along with Colonel Dwight Sullivan and Major Christian Broadson, represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Woodrick, in this case. The grounds for this appeal are not found on the face of the statute, nor in the legislative history of Article 62. Article 62 was enacted several years after the Criminal Appeals Act, 18 U.S.C. 3731. The updates to the federal statute were enacted in 1970. In this 1970 enactment, Congress included a provision that stated, "The provisions of this section shall be liberally construed to effectuate its purpose." This provision is notoriously lacking in Article 62. This court should rely on the plain language of Article 62 in deciding this case. This is a like right that was conferred by Congress. It is not the same right. Any comparison to federal law must take this into account.
Do we have to overrule True and its progeny for you to prevail on this issue?
Your Honor, to the extent it applies the effects test, which is solely derived from federal law pursuant to the clause in 18 U.S.C. 3731, this court must overrule True.
You only get to the effects test if you apply a liberal construction?
That does seem to be the intent of the effects test and the interpretation of federal law. They rely on the effects test based upon the liberal construction mandate in 3731.
Well, other than the Fifth Circuit in United States versus Smith, is there any case or any circuit outside of the military justice system that is applied in effects test other than for the dismissal clause of 3731?
There are several other ones. I believe the Second Circuit and the Sixth Circuit.
If you look at the plain language of 62, put aside liberal construction effects or whatever else, and just look at the language, what is your argument and what is your best argument? Dissect. I assume you're looking at subparagraph B.
I am, Your Honor. Subparagraph B deals with the exclusion of evidence that is substantial proof of a fact material in the proceeding.
What aspect of that are you focusing on? I know you've argued all in the alternative, but what's your best argument?
Appellant's best argument stems from the exclusion of evidence provision itself. As this court stated in Browers,
What's the difference between excluding evidence and suppressing evidence, and what's the word exclude mean? I understand that's a content question, so you can take them as you wish.
Appellant aversed that there's not much evidence between suppression and exclusion.
Then why'd they use both words in 3731? If they're the same thing, why didn't they just say suppression or exclusion?
That's a very good question, Your Honor.
Counsel, didn't Congress specifically add the word exclusion because suppression was considered to be too narrow?
In the enactment of 18 U.S.C. 3731.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what does the absence of the word suppression have to do with the present case before us?
The present case before us, then the implications of that 62 only applies, to exclusion.
Is anyone relying on suppression in this case?
I'm sorry, can you repeat
that? Is anyone relying on suppression in this case?
No, the government's argument is that this excluded was the
right.
functional.
Right. So what does the absence of the word suppression have to do with the case before us?
It does not have anything
to do with my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's why she was addressing it. And I'm asking you, do you care to offer this court a definition of suppression, a definition of exclusion, or the word exclude?
Appellant would like to offer a definition of the term exclusion, which was enunciated by this court in Browers.
You're talking about Judge Everett's definition of exclusion in Browers?
Yes, Your Honor.
And has that decision ever been called into question or overruled by this court?
It has not been called into question specifically because it dealt with, it's the only decision of this court that dealt with the second clause. The other Brooks, I believe, and Lincoln dealt with the first clause of Article 62. So Browers has not been dealt with subsequently.
Didn't Browers deal with the question of whether granting or denying a continuance can be mutated into the exclusion of evidence?
Yes, it did. That is how...
Okay. And here we have a quashing, a subpoena. Aren't they substantively different?
No, they're not, Your Honor.
They're the same thing? They're the same thing for these purposes?
For these purposes, Your Honor, but neither of them constitute the exclusion of evidence.
I mean, in both cases, wasn't the question whether the fact that a military judge made a ruling that might have the effect or was a but-for cause that evidence may or may not end up being admitted at court, that that was different than the plain word exclusion in the statute?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Counsel,
You still have the opportunity to answer my question, and if you want, you can save it for rebuttal. But before the day is done, I'd like you to define exclude for me. And if you want to define it slowly by C. Everett in Browers, you're welcome to do that. But then I have a question for you about C. Everett and Browers.
Your Honor.
You can save it for rebuttal if you want, but I don't want you to get interrupted to the point that you can't answer the question.
I'd like to define the term and then save for rebuttal whether or not you're the follow-up question to that, if I may.
I'd like you to answer both questions right now.
All right, Your Honor. The appellant would like to rely on Judge Everett's definition of exclusion of evidence pursuant to United States v. Browers.
Well, now he says most lawyers think of exclusion, but that apparently is not most lawyers or all lawyers sitting before us right here. Why is that necessarily the exclusive definition? And are there other plain language meanings of exclude that might be applicable?
Appellant cannot... Inadmissibility and exclusion, as far as Judge Everett defined it in Browers, is the only thing that comes to mind, and that's how appellant would define this. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Is it possible to, does the word exclude mean other things in other contexts without conceding your judgment that this is what it means in this context? But if the normal person walking down the street says, exclude, is this solely what they mean?
In the legal context, the appellant's argument is this is what it means to exclude evidence. Inadmissibility is exclusion.
So you're arguing not the plain meaning of the word exclude, you're arguing a term of art.
As it's defined by this court, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, on page 5 of your brief, your reply brief, you state that Browers stands for the proposition that Article 62 authorizes prosecution appeals of orders excluding evidence only where a military judge rules that certain evidence, quote, is inadmissible. Where in the statutory discussion of Browers does the word only appear?
It does not appear in the legislative history any.
Where does it appear in Browers?
Can you define the term again, Your Honor?
Only. It's your term. In your brief, you state that Browers stands for the proposition that only evidence that is inadmissible can be evidence that's excluded under the statute. Where does the word only appear in Browers? Where in Browers is there any language suggesting a bright line test?
The word only does not appear in Browers.
Is there any language in Browers suggesting a bright line test?
Other than what Judge Everett has cited, and that's how appellant would interpret that bright line test.
Well, as I read the quotation from Browers, the quotation that's in your brief, it not only references the language that Judge Baker referred to as what most lawyers think, it also states that this is a term of art usually isn't usually a term that courts use when they're discussing a concept that's subject to exceptions?
Admittedly, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, in Judge Everett's dissent in True, he mentioned that we should apply a liberal construction of Article 62, even though he then went on to find that the words of the statute meant what they said. Is there any room at all here for a liberal construction? Can we get any of that language from 3731 over into Article 62? Do you agree with what Judge Everett said in his dissent, or do you just think that the liberal construction is not pertinent at all to 62?
It's not pertinent at all in Article 62, based on the difference in the statutes and the fact that this was enacted long after the amendments to 3731, and Congress, in the legislative history, only adopted or framed this right in military courts only to the extent practicable, and specifically rejected the liberal construction mandate in 3731.
Does legislative history bear out the assertion that they positively rejected it, that they considered it and rejected it, or did they just pass over it?
There's no incantation of "we specifically reject this."
There's nothing in legislative history either. What is that what you're saying?
Not either way specifically on the issue.
Well, that's what I'm asking. I'm not asking the plain language of statute. I'm asking, is there any indication in legislative history that Congress considered this at all? Considered it and rejected it.
They clearly considered the statute. And their recommendations, they stated of
the statute being 3731.
Sorry,
right.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. They specifically stated that the recommendations regarding 62 maintain the essential balance between the need for an effective and efficient system of military discipline on the one hand and the important goal of preserving the fundamental rights of a defendant in any system of criminal justice on the other.
Go ahead.
Happy?
I'm happy.
Okay. I know we focus you on jurisdiction. Have you chosen to focus your argument on jurisdiction?
I have, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's say, for sake of argument alone, the jurisdictional hurdle is met. There's a dispute or a debate over whether the judge got it right in terms of whether this is cumulative evidence. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And was the judge, did the judge abuse his discretion in concluding that it was cumulative?
He did not, Your Honor.
And what is your response to the government's argument that not cumulative because of there are variations between the admissions and demeanor? There's a written statement, but there's also, when you have something on tape, there's demeanor evidence as well, which may go to credibility as well. What's your response to that?
I apologize for what's going to be probably a lengthy response to this question, but
as long as it's 2 minutes and 40 seconds long, there's no need for an apology.
2 minutes and 34 seconds.
The apparent first points to the fact that the lower court did not have the complete record that the military judge reviewed before them. They only had 3 out of the 5 statements. And the military judge went painstakingly through each of the reasons that it was cumulative. He went through the evidence already in the government's possessions. Now, as to the variations that the government points to, none of those are material whatsoever.
The painstaking review is on which page?
It's on the record at page 88. I don't know what page it is.
Okay, but the that's what's the painstaking part.
Yes, Your Honor. An appellate averse that it defies logic that the lower court could say that there was an abuse of discretion on the military judge's part when it did not have the entire record before the review.
Right. Now, I understand that, but do you disagree that there's variations between the statements?
No material variations. The broadcast, because due to the nature of the audience, is a little bit more detailed, but it's not substantively different from the appellant's, 3 out of 5, because that's all that's in the record, his statements as to his motivations and the acts that occurred on that day.
And what about the questions the journalist has asked where, I'm not quite sure how to phrase it, but the journalist puts facts in the question he's asking as if he's already been told that.
Those facts stem from the evidence that was before the military judge and the appellant's statements before the military judge.
Did CVS have access to that information? I thought that they did not.
Access to what information, Your Honor?
Well, you just said that the and I don't know how you refer to it, but the person that was taking the interview, the statements that he had before the question suggested that he already had information. You just said, or I thought you said, that it came from statements or things in the record or statements by the accused. And it was my understanding that CBS did not have that information in its possession.
I didn't mean to state what you're interpreting that I stated, Your Honor, okay. So I apologize for any confusion.
Okay. What's your answer to Judge Baker's question? Where did that information come from?
Insofar, the information that was... I see that my time is up. Can I finish?
You have time to answer that question and perhaps one more.
Your question again, Judge Baker, if you could articulate it for me, is...
Oh, boy. let me ask you another question. for the sake of argument alone, let's say there is jurisdiction. Let's say the military judge abused his discretion with respect to 703. Should or must this court say something, make a ruling with respect to the applicability, if any, regarding a reporter's privilege?
Appellant does not have a view on that, Your Honor.
The appellant will take what he gets either way if it gets to that point.
None of those issues on the reporter's privilege have been briefed to this court. So if this court does wish to decide that issue, appellant respectfully requests permission to brief those issues to this court.
That's the full sum of your answer. Let's say the appellant does not get that opportunity. Does the appellant today have a view as to whether we should or must address the applicability, if any, of a reporter's privilege?
It would, in the interest of justice, you should consider that today, Your Honor.
Why?
Because if this...
Why is that in the interest of justice?
Because failure to do that is only going to prolong this appeal, assuming that there is jurisdiction for this appeal. So it would be best to address all of that.
Doesn't it have an effect on your standing in this case? That is, that if the court either rules that there is a qualified privilege, or as some courts have done, weighs the First Amendment in the balancing test as to whether the judge abused his discretion or not, anything that we say on that, won't that affect your ability to obtain the same information should you need it for the defense in this case?
Is there a possibility that I could reserve that for rebuttal?
You can reserve that for rebuttal. But does the record before us tell us whether anyone other than CBS has a verbatim account of the complete interviews that appellant provided to CBS, including the outtakes?
There is no indication that anyone other than CBS may have this room.
Okay. Does the record tell us whether any of that information in the outtakes is exculpatory and beneficial for the defense?
There is no information in the record as to that, Your Honor.
Is there anything in the record that tells us whether it's inculpatory and beneficial to the government?
There is nothing in the record to that
Thank
effect
you.
Either, Your Honor. Appellants, lastly, would just urge this court to grant his petition for review in this case.
Thank you.
That concludes my argument.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Mr. Levine, counsel for CBS Broadcasting.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I think I should probably start with the question about the constitutional privilege that was raised. I think we have a difference of opinion with the accused on that issue.
And this is the should-shall question at the end there?
Yes.
As to if we got past jurisdiction?
Yes, okay. Yes. It's CBS's position, Your Honors, that the military judge did not rule on that issue. The Navy Court did not rule on that issue. That issue has not been briefed before this court. And the appropriate procedure, if we got to that point, would be to send it back to the military judge in the first instance to rule on the issue of the applicability of the privilege, specifically in the context of whether it obviates the need for in-camera review.
What about the appellant's argument that the interests of justice, including the appellant's opportunity, if tried, to have a timely trial, would be served by guidance, if not a decision, on applicability of any of the privilege? Let's say this thing goes back, all hypothetical, all for argument. Yes, there's jurisdiction. Yes, there's an abuse of discretion on 703. Now review it in camera and determine, one, whether it passes 703, two, whether there's a privilege if applicable, how it applies, and so on. But it goes back and CBS asserts it's privilege, we're not going to give it to the judge in camera. Is that a possibility for 703 basis?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
If we rule that this is hypothetical, if we rule that the judge abused his discretion with respect to the 703 rule, and we send it back to do the 703 part over again, pursuant to in-camera review, what if CBS then asserts a privilege with respect to the military judge, so he can't perform the 703? Is that a possibility?
Yes, that is a possibility, Your Honor. In fact,
and why wouldn't the interest of justice be served then to avoid multiple appeals to this court and therefore address the applicability, if any, of the privilege, not how it applies in this case, but whether it might apply in the abstract? Is the question clear?
There's
no statement in the question.
I understand. The reason is, Your Honor, simply that that issue has not been before this court, has not been briefed before this court. I think the court would be hard-pressed to make a decision on that in the absence of briefing by the parties. And the procedure that is usually followed in these circumstances is that if all the hypothetical chain unfolds as you suggest in your colloquy there, that what should happen is that the military judge would address the existence and applicability of the privilege before he undertakes in-camera review, because CBS has an interest, a privilege-based interest, in not having the in-camera review conducted in the first place beyond Rule 703. Does that answer your question?
It does answer my question. I think your answer is clear in this, but just to be clear, is it CBS's view that a privilege, qualified or otherwise, is applicable with respect to a military judge conducting an in-camera review?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So that when a judge is making a cumulativeness decision, the privilege issue has to be resolved first, in your view?
Before a decision is made to order in-camera review, yes, Your Honor, that is our position.
And which case would you cite that stands for the proposition that a trial judge cannot conduct in-camera review without making a decision on a qualified privilege or absolute privilege first?
The Zolan case didn't deal with the reporter's privilege, dealt with the attorney-client privilege, but there is language in the Zolan case in the Supreme Court that points out that the very fact of conducting in-camera review may well implicate interests that go to the usurping of the privilege or the infringement of the privilege, and courts ought to be cautious in ordering in-camera review for that very reason.
Right, but is there any case that's an absolute prohibition on a judge conducting an in-camera review prior to determining whether there's a privilege?
There have been a number of cases, Your Honor, in which the issue has been litigated.
Yeah.
The Cuthbertson case in the Third Circuit comes to mind, where the judge, in the first appeal of the Cuthbertson case, the trial judge made a ruling that the privilege applied and precluded him from conducting in-camera review. That then went up to the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit didn't disagree that a privilege analysis had to be undertaken. It just ruled that the privilege had been overcome, at least for the purpose of conducting in-camera review. Then the in-camera review was conducted, and ultimately both the trial court and the Third Circuit held that the information was privileged. But the sequence of rulings clearly contemplates that a threshold privilege determination has to be made before in-camera review can be ordered.
In Cuthbertson, did they determine that everything was privileged or that some of the information had to be disclosed?
In the first round of Cuthbertson, the court held that some of the requested information wasn't even properly subject to in-camera review, that it was privileged or protected by Rule 17. I'm blanking on whether it was both or one or the other. The other part, the court held that in-camera review was proper, that a sufficient showing had been made to overcome both Rule 17 and the privilege. When it went up the second time, my recollection is that the court ruled that none of the information in the outtakes had to be produced to the other side after the in-camera review.
Courts have discussed when judges have conducted in-camera review, whether it was appropriate or not. Where do we look for guidance on the question of whether a judge abuses his or her discretion in declining to conduct in-camera review, and what standard should apply there?
I think it's the same standard, Your Honor. It's an abuse of discretion standard, and your job on this appeal is to determine whether the military judge abused his discretion by declining to undertake an in-camera review.
What would we look for, and what type of case? This may be not one that's easy for you to answer, but where is there any case in which a judge would abuse his discretion by not conducting an in-camera review?
I can, given the high standards for what constitutes an abuse of discretion, this court uses language including the word fanciful in describing what the district judge's exercise of judgment has to be to warrant it being reversed on an abuse of discretion standard. So it's hard for me to posit a case where that would happen. I suppose it is theoretically possible, but the government sets out the test in the Clement case as one that a judge should apply before conducting in-camera review, which, as the court knows, requires a reasonable likelihood that the information that's being sought is going to constitute relevant evidence, that it's not available from other sources, and that it wouldn't be cumulative. I think if you take that test and apply it to what happened here, there is, in fairness, no way that you can say that Judge Meeks acted in a fanciful manner and abused his discretion in concluding, based on this record, that whether or not there was admissible evidence was entirely speculative, that there were a host of alternative sources that the government could go to for this information, and indeed a host of alternative sources that it already had that had functionally the same that contained functionally the same information, so that they already had the information that they needed.
Among the information that the government had at its disposal, though it's not yet been admitted, if I'm not mistaken, is the broadcast itself. You did produce that, right?
Yes, we did.
And you did agree to authenticate it?
Yes, we did, Your Honor.
And the government, when you requested the information that they had so that you could conduct a comparison between the outtakes and that information already in their possession, declined to give you that information.
Declined to give it to us, and the Navy Court denied our motion to compel the government to both give it to us and to them. So the Navy Court didn't have it in front of it. On this question of abuse of discretion, Your Honors, the great fallacy in this case that is the government's operating assumption is that there are material distinctions between the broadcast and what the government already has from other sources, such that you could posit then that the outtakes must contain similar kinds of distinctions.
Do we have to rely on CBS's word for that? You're the only people who have all the stuff.
What you don't have to rely on our word for, Your Honor, is to take a look at the comparison between the broadcast statements and the other information that's available.
No, I'm talking about the comparison between the broadcast statement, the broadcast, and the outtakes. What are we relying on for your assertion that there's no material difference between the outtakes, or is that the assertion you're making?
That is not the assertion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
The assertion I'm making is that the legs get cut out from under the government's argument when you look at what are the material facts in this case, and you realize that even taking the broadcast statements into account, they're not in dispute. You go through each of the things that the government points to. There's no dispute in this case that Staff Sergeant Uderich's squad received small arms fire from the south, The government even concedes it in its brief. There's no dispute that Staff Sergeant Wooderich told his squad to shoot first and ask questions later. It's contained in multiple statements. There's no dispute that he told them not to worry about the personal identification requirement and that he didn't follow it himself on a person-by-person basis. There's no dispute that he fully understood the rules of engagement and he, in fact, served as an instructor for the members of his squad on the rules of engagement. His defense isn't that he didn't understand the rules of engagement. It's that he, in fact, understood them and complied with them. There's no dispute that he didn't himself see fire coming from House 1 and never claimed to have seen it. There's no dispute that he didn't see anyone running from House 1 to House 2 himself and never claimed to have seen it. It doesn't matter whether he assumed that someone had run out of the open door in House 1 to House 2 or whether someone in his squad told him that had happened. It doesn't matter whether, as the comment that Mr. Pelley makes in the broadcast in posing the question, it doesn't matter whether House 1 caught his eye as opposed to Corporal Salinas telling him that there was fire coming from that house. None of those distinctions are material. When you take a step back, and this is what I think Judge Meeks did below, you take a step back, there is no difference between the statements contained in the broadcast on which the government relies to show that it needs the outtakes and the actual other facts in the record. This is not a case where material facts are in dispute. It's a case in which there's a question of whether, based on the material facts that pretty much everyone agrees to, an offense was committed. So under those circumstances, it's very hard for us to understand how it is that Judge Meeks could have been said to have abused his discretion by saying that the government hadn't carried its burden of making a sufficient showing. At the worst, reasonable people could differ on the subject, but that's well lower than an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, as I understand the record, the outtakes, the military judge referred to representation that the outtakes consist of several hours of interview between Mr. Pelley and the appellant in this case. Is that a fair statement of what the record is?
The only statement in the record that I'm aware of, Your Honor, is a statement by defense counsel who was present during the taping in which he uses the term hours to describe the
multiple
amount of time that Mr. Pelley spent with Staff Sergeant Wooderich. There's nothing in the record about how long the taping actually.
Okay. The broadcast is less than.
Just clarify, sure. On page 87, the military judge says, coupled with the representation that there are several hours of outtakes.
That's not by us.
But that's the representation of defense counsel.
Yes.
Okay,
my
so it's a bootstrap there. It's in the record, but it's a bootstrap of the state. Okay.
What should we proceed on? Are there outtakes?
I'm sorry?
Are there outtakes?
Yeah, there are definitely
outtakes. And the broadcast itself is less than a half hour.
Factor in commercials, yeah. I think that's probably right.
And as defense counsel noted,
I think it's probably more than a half hour, yeah. Your Honor. It's less than an hour.
Okay. As defense counsel noted in response to my questions, and perhaps there's other information in the record, under the record, no one other than CBS knows whether this information is exculpatory, whether it's inculpatory, or whether it would otherwise shed light on the information that's otherwise at issue in this case. The defense vigorously contests that appellant has confessed to anything. Under those circumstances, why hasn't the government made a sufficient showing that the outtakes in which the accused discussed the events of the day at the place of the charged offenses should be made available to the parties in this case to determine, or at least to the military judge, to determine whether they are, in fact, cumulative of other information? I understand the arguments as to cumulativeness based on the information that's available, but who, other than CBS, a news gathering organization, and not a party to the underlying court-martial, knows the value of the information that's in the outtakes?
I feel compelled to tell the court that, as I mentioned earlier, defense counsel was present for the entire session.
So I'm just asking what's on the record in this case.
That's in the record.
Yeah.
Right. So presumably defense counsel knows.
We don't know whether defense counsel has a verbatim.
He definitely doesn't have the outtakes.
Right.
But does he know what was said and what wasn't said in his presence there? That's a different.
At this stage, it's not in the record whether he has any recording of that.
He has no recording of it. I'm not suggesting that he does.
And the government doesn't have it either, does it?
No.
Counsel, if I could ask a quick question on jurisdiction before you sit down. I understand that the military judge granted your motion to quash the subpoena, correct?
Correct.
Is there anything about that order that precludes CBS from changing its mind or reaching an accommodation with the government or the defense or whomever in the future in which, and I'm not suggesting that CBS by answering this question is conceding that it would do that, but is there anything about the judge's order that keeps CBS from reaching an accommodation with the government or the defense to turn over some or all the outtakes?
Nothing in the judge's order, Your Honor.
Thank
Could you address briefly the slippery slope concerns you may have about if jurisdiction is found in this case?
Yes, it is.
That's part of what your argument is about.
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor.
Sort of give me your three best arguments or the three arguments you hope we are considering if we ever get to that point.
And you're talking about whether the Navy Court had jurisdiction point.
Right, but one of the arguments made is that if there's jurisdiction in Article 62, then Article 62 is going to be used to referee discovery, and then it's going to be used to referee in-camera review of anything a journalist ever does. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I sense that that's a concern.
Yes, you said that quite well.
How would the facts in this case prevent a slippery slope from, being this kind of slope or this kind of slope, in your view? What are the key distinctions? I understand your argument is the key distinction is it's privileged, so you don't get there, but putting aside that, what are your concerns here and how might they be protected?
I think, and this may be a slight detour to getting to the answer to your question, but I need to set it up just a bit.
Please.
And I think we do differ a bit with the defense on this. As I read the True decision and the application of the effects test in the True decision, they're talking about the provision of Article 62 that deals with the termination of proceedings. If you have a termination of a proceeding, by definition, none of the practical problems of interlocutory appeals are really implicated. The proceeding's over. So taking an appeal at that juncture isn't going to slow anything down, isn't going to disrupt the otherwise orderly process. On the other hand, if you're talking about a ruling excluding evidence or a ruling that has the effect of excluding the evidence in some sort of but-for cause sense, you are opening the floodgates to every time there is a ruling the government doesn't like, that it can stitch together an argument that it will ultimately deprive it of evidence, whether it be granting it a continuance because a witness is unavailable, or whether it be in a situation like this where a discovery ruling has been made, and because the government has come out on the short end of this, they say they're ultimately not going to get evidence that they can put in, you're going to give the government tremendous incentive to take an interlocutory appeal every time they're on the short end of one of those rulings. And if you then superimpose an in-camera review requirement on top of that in every case that the broadcast media has covered in some sense, which would be any military proceeding that involved a matter of public concern, you would have a situation where courts would be, the military court would be obliged to undertake an in-camera review. And if you're telling the military judges down there that on a record like this you abuse your discretion if you don't conduct an in-camera review, they are going to have a tremendous incentive to err on the side of conducting in-camera review in all cases, which is going to disrupt the proceedings. I mean, let's assume for a, a moment, the Chief Judge was suggesting that there are hours of outtakes here. The judge is going to have to review all of
them. I wasn't suggesting that. I was referring to the representation of the judge in the record.
That there have to be hours of review of that. And you can hypothesize other cases where there are many more outtakes. It seems to me that that's why, to circle back to the true point, there is a distinction between those two provisions of Article 62. Having an effects test and paralleling 3731 in the context of a termination of proceedings or something that has the practical effect of terminating the entire proceeding is one thing, but doing it in the context of a ruling that has, in a but-for cause sense, the effect of excluding evidence is something different and really will make a work a very significant change, which I respectfully suggest that it's going to be worked, ought to be worked at the hands of Congress.
There's no indication in the record, or is there, that anything on the outtakes was background on background?
No. So my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge, I'm sorry for not concurring with the clerk earlier, but in your discretion, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
It's granted.
Mr. Chief Judge Efron, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Timothy Delgado, and I, along with Colonel Luis Pulio, represent the government. This case is about the standards that should govern the enforcement of a federal subpoena in light of a claim of privilege. It seems that there has been a fundamental confusion that's pervaded this case at all levels. And Judge Ryan, I'd like to address your question as well as, Mr. Chief Judge, your question as well, that describe or at least seem to differentiate between the outtakes versus the broadcast admissions. By bifurcating.
Do we have to decide the privilege question, decide this?
No, Your Honor. This case came up here on 703 grounds. The lower court addressed it on 703 grounds and intended to send it back on those grounds. Privilege is not before the court.
I have a question about that, but they're probably interested in hearing your answer to their question, but I don't know.
I didn't realize I had a question.
Well, ask her to repeat it.
I have another question.
What was my question?
This goes to, you're saying decide this on 703 grounds alone.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It goes back on 703 grounds. This is the hypothetical I put to CBS. It goes back on 703 grounds. CBS asserts privilege and doesn't produce the material to the judge for in-camera review for 703 review. The case is back here. Appellants indicated, wait a second, what about my timely trial here? Get on with it. You're saying that's fine with you. Let's take as long as it takes to send this back a couple of times and work the privilege
through.
We
appreciate the delay attendant in this appeal. But Congress has envisioned this in Article 62C and decided that these types of delays would be acceptable in the interest of justice. The government will not have a chance to appeal this if it goes to trial and the appellant's acquitted. As much as we would like to invite the court to resolve the privilege issue right now and just get it done with, procedure counts, and that would be beyond.
And when I say address the privilege issue, not necessarily decide it.
Correct, Your Honor.
But your position is the same. Don't even mention it.
Your Honor.
Don't bring it up, whatever you do.
Our position is
I think CBS would probably be happy with that as well.
They may, Your Honor. I think, again, this case was decided by the lower court simply on whether or not the judge abused his discretion and made an arbitrary ruling after finding that the evidence was cumulative without reviewing the majority of that. And that mistake was inherent in the fact that he considered this issue as one of outtakes versus broadcast admissions. That's not correct. Our ability to support or enforce this federal subpoena shouldn't be contingent upon whether CBS chose to broadcast 5 minutes of interview footage, 30 minutes, or several hours. The enforcement of our federal subpoena is something that should be considered in toto. And the judge, he actually found that it was cumulative in toto. It was the entire subpoena that was quashed, not just parts of it.
Well, let's start at the beginning. I realize you'd like to jump into the issues that where you think that the military judge got it wrong, but one of the issues that this court has to think about in the first instance is whether the CCA had jurisdiction. And what I'd like for you to explain to me is why the first circuit's view, which is exactly what CBS's counsel articulated, which is that while you look at the first clause, the something that terminates a proceeding broadly, you don't carry that over to the second clause with respect to excluding evidence. Why isn't the First Circuit right?
The First Circuit's not right, Your Honor.
Because why?
Because in Wilson, the Supreme Court said that, yes, under the first prong of 3731, the government should have the broadest possible rights to appeal under the Constitution. And that was because of the double jeopardy concerns that would be raised were the proceedings terminated. But that logic applies with equal force under the second prong, because if we assert and we contend that there is case dispositive critical evidence and we are not allowed to procure that evidence and present
it. Are you arguing this is case dispositive evidence?
We are not required to do so, Your Honor.
Well, what you just said that it was. I mean, are you suggesting, and I'll ask you this because this is a question I have, is it the government's position that without the outtakes, it doesn't have evidence for every element of every specification of every charged offense?
Not at all, Your Honor. This is substantial proof, but it's not the only proof. And the courts that have interpreted Article 62 have not required that it be the only proof.
And I'm not suggesting that it is, but you're saying that this is critical evidence, and you talked about the procedures under 62C and the delay attendant with the 62 appeal. And I guess that my question is that, you know, you've talked about the double jeopardy concerns, and there's another concern, which is speedy trial. Now, you in your brief have suggested that there is no speedy trial concern with respect to Staff Sergeant Ruderick because it's excludable delay, but that seems a little bit disingenuous. I mean, the fact that it's excludable delay doesn't mean that Staff Sergeant Ruderick isn't interested in having his trial sooner rather than later. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it's true that he's lost two of his defense counsel, correct? Or he's going to lose his second one?
Yes, Your Honor. That assertion has been made, and we have no position on that.
And this is over a military judge's ruling on a discovery issue, right?
Yep. On whether or not
it was going to quash the subpoena or not.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. To kind of answer your question in order, first of all, the government is only required to allege that this constitutes substantial proof. It doesn't have to be the only proof. And in this case, that assertion has been made by the designee of the Judge Advocate General. With regard to the delay that is attendant, yes, this is an issue that may stand to prejudice Staff Sergeant Woodridge. With that in mind, though, Congress and the President have both envisioned these types of delay. But more than that.
But that's the question, isn't it? I mean, the question is what Congress and the President have talked about specifically is an order excluding evidence, okay? And you're suggesting that we should read that broadly to include any ruling by a military judge that might have the effect of making it impossible or difficult for the government to present evidence or obtain evidence. You want us to read it broadly. The appellant wants us to read it narrowly. United States versus Wilson talks about specific statutory direction. Okay, and so I'm asking you, in light of all the things that you're talking about, which is you're acknowledging the prejudice, you're acknowledging that it's going to take time, you're acknowledging all of these things, and you still want us to read it broadly, and my question is why?
I guess, Your Honor, because for 19 years this court has done so. And
in a case specifically like this, I don't think so.
Not on a motion to quash, Your Honor. This is an issue of first impression, but in cases very similar to this, abatement orders, for instance.
An abatement order in which this court held that because it was almost certain that it was going to end up in a dismissal, they treated it as a dismissal issue, not an exclusion of evidence issue.
That is correct, Your Honor. But in terms of
and that would be the first prong, correct? Not the second prong.
Correct, Your Honor. As for the exclusion of evidence, no, Your Honor. There is no case from this court directly on point. All I would refer the court to is persuasive precedent from the federal circuits, in particular from United States versus Smith in the Fifth Circuit, where a motion to quash was actually held as justiciable.
And that case has been criticized by the First Circuit, correct?
It has, Your Honor.
And the other cases or the other circuits that you would look to, rather than being a motion to exclude evidence that was read broadly, they were contingent exclusions, where basically the military judge said, government, if you don't do X, I'm going to exclude the evidence. And the government said, well, I'm not going to do X, and that was allowed to be appealed, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, that is correct. But Wilson's logic applies with equal force here, because if this case goes to trial and there is an acquittal, we will not get to appeal this. And that's why this court has held in Brooks, in Lincoln, and just last term in Lopez de Victoria, that 3731 is to inform this court's interpretation of Article 62.
But 3731 is the statute that is looked at in the federal circuits, and you've, I think, just agreed with me that other than United States versus Smith, there's not another circuit case out there with facts like these where they've held that it applies.
That is correct, Your Honor. This is the issue of a motion to quash, whether or not that constitutes an exclusion of substantial proof, is an issue of first impression.
And why wouldn't we follow Judge Everett's definition of when evidence is excluded for purposes of Article 62, as opposed to the rather more loose standard United States versus Smith adopted?
Because in this case, Your Honor, Congress has, first, every time that they have adopted or have updated the UCMJ, they've done so within the backdrop of United States versus Chu and the functional effects test. It's the functional effects test here that, Your Honor, I believe you're calling into question, and not, in fact, whether or not a motion to quash qualifies.
Well, I mean, a functional effect, I mean, any time that a military judge or in a district court, any time that a discovery dispute is brought to the attention of a judge and they rule one way or the other, okay, you can make the argument that it makes it more or less difficult for one party or the other to either obtain or present evidence. And if that constitutes exclusion, I think that CBS's slippery slope argument has some great truth to it. And it's not my understanding that it's ever been interpreted that broadly in any court in this country, other than United States versus Smith.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but we are not opening the floodgates here. For one, I don't believe the functional effects test itself is your primary concern, Your Honor. It's this limiting principle. And I guess the strongest answer I have to that is that in this case, there are no alternative remedies. The government will have no other means of going about obtaining this evidence. And that was not the case in United States versus Browers, where Judge Cox's concurrence pointed out that the government, the convening authority, is free to withdraw and re-prefer if, on a denial of a continuance motion, the government's case might fail for failure.
Could you address that argument more directly to the concern that, that this isn't just a discovery slippery slope, but it's a potentially slippery slope with respect to journalists? Would that not always be the case with news gathering or whatever material held by media organizations?
It may be, Your Honor, but I guess CBS has created this problem. They have set up a false dichotomy in outtakes versus broadcast admissions. And by saying, we will authenticate and give you the broadcast admissions.
No, I don't want to talk about that for the moment. I'm focused on if exclude reaches discovery disputes and motions to quash, and every motion to quash is subject to appeal in theory.
Yes, Your Honor, I follow.
And therefore, every motion to quash something held in a journalist capacity is subject to appeal. What assurance does the government or can the government give to this court at this time that there are legal barriers to using that as a automatic button? You file your, produce all statements by the accused, produce all interviews with any journalistic entity, and you make that paragraph 94 on your discovery request.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess it would be the availability of other remedies. How can we go about, where a privilege has been asserted, it's pretty clear that there is no negotiation to be had, that we're not going to get this out. And I think that's...
What are the other remedies when a news organization has something and they say it's protected by privilege?
Getting it from the source directly, Your Honor. In this case, that is not, that's not going to happen. The appellant has asserted that even if he were to claim a completeness or to raise a completeness objection, CBS would still raise this.
Get it from the source who's a confidential informant? Get it from the source who doesn't want to talk to the government?
No, Your Honor, I think we're now moving into privilege grounds. And the limiting... I guess, Your Honor, Congress has provided, and this Court has put its imprimatur on the government's broad right to appeal. The issue of whether or not a judge has abused his discretion on the issue of relevance, materiality, and necessity is distinct from whether or not we even get in the door. So, yes, Your Honor,
I guess... the protection that they still have, the government would still have to meet relevance and necessity? That's the ultimate protection to the...
That is not... No, Your Honor. That is the merits question that would be raised in the 62 appeal. As far as getting in the door, the justiciability issue, I don't know that there would be a hard and fast limiting principle. The government would have the ability, where a judge quashes a subpoena, to take an interlocutory appeal under the precedence of this Court.
And this may have been implicit in your response to Judge Ryan, but how do you define the word exclude as used in 62 in plain English? Or you can use fancy English too, but.
Yes, Your Honor, I guess.
The appellant has defined it as, see Judge Everett. How do you define it?
As the keeping out of the possession of one who is requesting. I mean, that's a common sense argument, Your Honor. The question here is, do we have a legal right to it? And 703 is the proper mode of inquiry.
Good definition, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is based on dictionary definitions, or is there a case for that, or is that just you're saying that, no, that...
No, Your Honor.
It's common sense.
I guess that's common sense, Your Honor. I guess the only other thing I would point to is MRE 103A, which talks about exclusion. But that has no hard and fast definition either.
Okay.
I'm going to give a statement, and I want you
to give me the opposite, okay? The evidence was excluded. The evidence was...
Not excluded.
So it's not admitted. That sounds like what I remember judges saying all the time. The evidence is not excluded. It's the evidence is admitted, correct?
No, Your Honor. No. Admissibility at trial is distinct from cumulativeness and the acquisition of evidence pretrial. That's a problem in this case. Whether or not evidence will be excluded or admissible at trial, excluded or not excluded, for trial purposes is quite distinct from in the acquisition during the pretrial phases. The judge is firmly in control of what evidence is cumulative or what evidence is admissible at trial. But in terms of the cumulativeness determination pretrial, that's something that the litigants are entitled to. And Congress, as well as the President, have said, and this Court has said, that discovery is to be liberally had in the military system in Article 46. I mean, this is our case.
Okay,
and we will present it with the best evidence available.
Well, let's say that you reach an accommodation with CVS. Okay, and they decide to give you enough of the outtakes that you quit appealing so that Staff Sergeant Ruderick's trial can continue. Okay, and you go to court and you try to have it admitted, right? You say, I move the admission of Prosecution Exhibit 5, right? And the military judge says, you know, denied. I find it's cumulative, too prejudicial, whatever. Okay, you could appeal that, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay, let's say instead that you somehow get a copy of the outtakes without the complicity of CBS, and you go to admit them. You say, I move the admission, and the judge says they're admitted. Okay? And then Staff Sergeant Ruderick can't appeal till after his trial is over, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If the military judge, and you're saying that the military judge, by ruling on the motion to quash the subpoena, excluded the evidence, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If he had denied the motion, would you say that he had admitted the evidence?
No, Your Honor. We would then ask for enforcement of the federal subpoena. And that is a different question from admission at trial itself.
Okay, so exclusion means different things at trial than it does during discovery, but admission means different things.
That is correct. Admission is only a trial concept, Your Honor. Admission is not a pretrial concept.
An exclusion is a concept that changes depending on when you're looking at it?
No, exclusion would be informed. We have to, it's coupled with the cumulativeness analysis in this case. The necessity under 703, under the relevance, materiality, and necessity.
I think I understand your position.
I have one last question.
Yes, sir.
The appellant and CVS have both argued that there is no variance between what the government has in terms of admissions and what is reflected in the on 60 Minutes broadcast. What are your two best illustrations, if any, contesting that argument?
Positive identification was the biggest thing that showed his clear understanding, and that's and that was then followed by a detailed description of the rules of understanding, Your Honor. That's not duplicated anywhere else in the materials. The second would be his admission that he observed women and dead women and children in House 1 prior to transitioning to House 2. He said that he observed women and children in House 1 and that they were still in the assault. And we contend that that admission is not replicated anywhere else. It goes directly to his willfulness in disregarding the laws of war, as well as the unlawfulness of the killing in transitioning to House 2. If we can show that he was aware that there were women and children, civilians in House 1, and he was in a residential environment, then the transition to House 2, and his considering that he was still in the assault, our argument at trial will be that that represents an unlawful act, a willful dereliction. And so, Your Honor, those are the two most material variations between the two statements, not to mention his demeanor, his voice inflections.
Fair enough. I asked for
yes,
two.
Your Honor. But, okay. Thank you, sir.
Counsel, if we determine that the lower court was wrong on standing, wrong on finding facts that were not found by the military judge, and wrong in other respects, is it within our authority, since this is an issue of law, to disregard the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals completely and go directly to the ruling of the military judge and determine whether the military judge abused or did not abuse his discretion?
Your Honor, because this is an Article 62 appeal, I think that as a preliminary matter, this court reviews rulings and orders, not opinions. Now, I think you would be obligated to review or at least consider the ruling of the lower court. But as the highest court in this military justice system, de novo review is obviously called for on all matters of law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, do you have a rebuttal?
If I may first get back to Judge Baker's question, assuming that you still want this answered, Your Honor. Assuming that I have it correct, I'm going to read it back to you. Your question regarding Scott Pelley's discussion with appellant and where the facts came from, the questions that he asked, is that still your question?
Please.
I wanted to make sure that I got it right. Those questions did come from the discussion with appellant. I think that's a fair inference from the record, but anything in those is replicated in appellant's statements as well.
What do you care to respond to the government's statement a second ago about examples of variance?
There are no material variances in what the government proposes. He's not going, the appellant in this case is not going to talk about PID, but his rationale and why a PID, why he applied the rules of engagement is apparent from the statements.
What about his knowledge that there are women and children in House 1?
Appellant
is that
has
reflected in other statements?
That it, not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
I'm just repeating what the government said. I'm not making an argument.
I don't recall off the top of my head, but the fact of the matter is, on that day, the squad was receiving fire, and his rationale for doing what he did is consistent in the entirety of the record before this court.
Then why isn't the material in the outtakes essential for the prosecution case? You have vigorously contested that appellant has confessed to anything in this case. You've also acknowledged that nobody knows what are in those outtakes.
It's the government has articulated why it needs this evidence, Your Honor. It wants to know the why appellant did what he did, and that is evident from the record before this court. He states over and over
that why. That may be evident from the defense perspective, but how do you know that it's evident from the prosecution perspective? That is, it may give them enough to, if he's convicted, to survive a Jackson test on legal sufficiency. But the government has an obligation to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt to a military court-martial. Why doesn't the government have the same right as the defense under Article 46 to have access to any information made by the statements made by an opposing party in this case, unless the military judge determines that it's cumulative, a determination that he made without ever knowing what was in those outtakes?
The military judge did not abuse his discretion in determining that they were cumulative. The government's articulated rationale for wanting this information is why, which is sufficiently and completely addressed in the evidence that it has before it. It has what it needs to go to prosecute this case.
What case stands for the proposition that cumulative is equivalent to minimum necessary for a party? Would that be the standard for the defense, that a defendant is limited in its subpoena to evidence that is the minimum necessary for the defense, or does the defense have the opportunity to get the best exculpatory evidence that's available to introduce at trial?
There's no parity, and in federal courts have acknowledged that the right is not the same as far as the government and the defense are going. This government appeals were not established to...
We're not talking about government appeals. We're talking about the ruling of the military judge in Article 46, which says that the prosecution, the defense, and the court-martial shall have equal access to obtaining evidence.
To obtain it, but not equal access. Discovery... Subpoena is not a substitute for discovery, Your Honor.
I'm not sure where that takes us in this case.
I don't know that I can sufficiently answer your question.
Okay, thank you.
I apologize. Briefly, appellant would just like to avert that these statutes are different. Any logic in Wilson was specifically, interpreting the federal statute, which was not intended to mirror, and 62 was not intended to mirror this federal statute. This court does not have jurisdiction.
Isn't that what this court said in Browers? You rely on Browers. Doesn't Browers specifically say that we look to the federal Article 3 courts for guidance on the interpretation of Article 62?
Appellant is unaware of that specific clause.
You might want to take a look at it, and if you want to address it further, we'll give you the opportunity to do so.
I see that I'm over my time. If there are no more questions, thank you.
Counsel for CBS.
I want to address something that the government said at the outset of its argument that seems to form the basis of its appeal, but I think is indisputably incorrect, and that is the notion that the military judge made a determination that the broadcast statements were not admissible, and that he lumped the two together and made an undifferentiated ruling that they were both cumulative. He did not make such a ruling. You can read the military judge's comments in the record, and he very clearly stopped short of making any ruling with respect to the admissibility of the broadcast statements, and specifically stopped short of saying anything about their necessity. The government is free at any time to move to pre-admit the broadcast. It hasn't done that. And the statements that the government referred to in response to Judge Baker's question are contained in the broadcast. So if they believe that they need this statement about women and children, it's in the broadcast, and it hasn't been ruled inadmissible in any way. Beyond that, I think it's something of a red herring, this women and children business. It's undisputed that women and children died in that house, It's undisputed the room they were in the house when they were killed. It's undisputed that Staff Sergeant Woodard went into that room as part of clearing the house. And it seems to me pretty much common sense that he saw that what was there and that the government can at least make that argument below at a court-martial trial of this case.
Counsel, without the did you have,
go ahead.
Without the outtakes, as a practical or legal matter, can the government move to pre-admit the outtakes?
I think it would be very difficult for them to do that, Your Honor. I think the sequence of events would have to be to move to pre-admit the broadcast. If the judge rules that the broadcast, let's hypothetically say it rules that the broadcast is admissible, then a further request to get the outtakes or something like that, I think would raise the same cumulative, not necessary arguments that we've.
So we'd be in the same place. That in other words, what I was trying to figure out here is whether the government has waived anything by not making that motion with respect to the outtakes in this case.
I would not take a position that they waived anything, Your Honor.
Judge Baker?
With respect to the rules of engagement, just to pick up on that for a second, in all of Staff Sergeant Weirich's statements that are in the record of this case, he talks about the personal identification requirement. He talks about the fact that he understood it, but that he didn't feel that it applied in this situation and the reasons why. There's nothing additional in the broadcast with respect to that that isn't already in the other statements.
Do you want to offer a definition of exclude or draw our attention to something other than what the parties are?
Actually, I do, Your Honor, and I appreciate the opportunity. I want to second the defendant's position with respect to Browers, and as I read Browers, getting back to a question that the Chief Judge asked earlier, not only does it define the term in the way that lawyers typically use it, but it goes on to say, and I quote, "We see no reason to believe that Congress had any different intention in drafting Article 62A1. To me, that says that the court was saying that's the definition that Congress intended, or at least that's what we're ruling.
So that Congress intended that there be a different definition in military proceedings than in civilian proceedings?
Well, I think at the time,
Do you think that that is a different definition?
That's what I was just going to say, Your Honor. I don't think it's a different definition. What True has to say about, well, it's not True we're talking about. What Smith has to say was obviously much later and is an outlier as far as I'm concerned.
Wasn't there a Third Circuit case, Colucci, that arose in 1979, a grand jury case, that interpreted 3731 and gave it the effects test and specifically dealt with quashing a subpoena and said that quashing a subpoena is it has the effect of excluding evidence, and so we got a Third Circuit case that's in effect at the time that that Congress enacted Article 62. Not necessarily they were aware of it, but was there anything contrary to the state of the law? Was there anything in the state of the law as it existed at the time Article 62 enacted in which Congress would have had before it an understanding that the term exclude only means inadmissible?
Other than the way that people that practice law in courts understand it.
Right. I am not aware of a specific case that addressed the definition. I am aware, obviously, it's later, but I'm aware of the First Circuit cases that Judge Ryan was referring to earlier.
Did that case hold that the term exclude only means inadmissible?
It didn't reach that question.
Thank you.
Is my time up or am I?
You're available to answer any questions that my colleagues might have.
Did you have anything else you want to say and felt constrained?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge, there are basically just two issues that I wanted to touch on in rebuttal. One, If, for some reason, this court finds that there is no jurisdiction to hear this case, I would refer the, or I invite the court's attention to United States versus Ramsey, 28 MJ 370, in which this court dismissed an appellant's petition for lack of jurisdiction and treated the appeal as a petition for an extraordinary writ. So that alternative is available. More substantively, though, in the rebuttals of both appellant and CBS, they've indicated that they know what is best for the process, how we should prosecute this case. For instance, it's in the broadcast. They can have the broadcast. We did not subpoena the broadcast, and we did not subpoena the outtakes. We subpoenaed all footage from the time that the camera started rolling until the time that they ended. We've made a showing of both relevance and materiality. The judge in the lower court agreed with us on those points. What necessity and the cumulative nature of the admissions contained therein are in dispute here. Our position is that we know two things about these admissions, and not just the outtakes, not the broadcast admissions, but the admissions that were made during the appellee interview. These are admissions by an accused to about the events for which he stands on trial. There is no evidence that could be more probative, more reflective of his subjective impressions and intent and state of mind.
Counsel, how do you know that? The information in the outtakes may be worthless for all you know.
Your Honor, the information in the outtakes is part of a larger universe, the subset of which includes the broadcast admissions. Based on what we know is present in the broadcast itself, we know that there is, or at least we can infer that there is very likely going to be information that is similarly probative in the outtakes. Just the terms editorial discretion, I mean, that connotes First Amendment terms. We're not interested in that. We want the full set of outtakes, or I'm sorry, the full set of
I understand that, counsel, but what I was asking about is comments. Your comments are similar to those made by the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case about the material. And as far as I understand the record in this case and the response of the parties today, nobody knows what's in those outtakes. Now, that may not necessarily hurt you, may not necessarily help you. We'll have to decide what that means. But isn't that the state of the record before us, that nobody knows whether during those outtakes there is anything in here that's going to help the government, help the defense, or otherwise be useful in this case?
There's nothing we can point to, Your Honor, directly within those outtakes.
You said nobody knows?
Well CBS certainly knows.
CBS. Nobody other than CBS.
Correct. Does defense counsel know?
They said that
not
defense...
Not part of the record, the defense counsel was present during his...
Your Honor, from information outside the record, I know that defense counsel was present during the interview, but that is not contained within the record. So...
Counsel, I have a question that's sort of related, and I certainly don't pretend that I don't think any judge on this bench is pretending that we know how to try the government's case better than the government does, but a question with respect to television. I'm not much of a TV watcher, but it would seem to me that if there was, you know, more outrageous or interesting comments on the outtakes, that they would have been put in the broadcast because they would be more interesting to the audience.
Your Honor, if it bleeds, it leads. What is necessary and material and interesting for inclusion on a broadcast may not be what is relevant and necessary for the government's case. Trials and proving up elements is relatively a mundane task. But we will make the determination on what is legally necessary. And we know for a fact that this interview contains admissions by an accused about the event for which he is charged. He wasn't talking about conditions in Iraq generally. There's no reason to believe that this is a fishing expedition. Scott Pelley avers in his declaration that this interview concerned 19 November in Haditha. That's what we're looking to cull through. We have a legal right to it, and 703, we contend and we submit to the court that the lower court did make an arbitrary determination when he found that the evidence was cumulative without reviewing it.
Without presuming or assuming any legal importance to this, is it the government's view that the positive ID and the woman and children in House 1 is not part of the broadcast portion of the 60 Minutes thing?
No, that is part of the broadcast. It's part of the interviews, Your Honor. We know that. I mean, it's part of the Pelley interview.
The broadcast portion of it.
The broadcast portion of it, but it's also part of the Pelley interview, and it's the Pelley interview.
No, I understand that argument. I just was making sure I understood what part of the rebuttal argument you were...
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
That's why I didn't want you... I said, don't just answer the question.
But yes, Your Honor.
Do you understand, and you don't have to agree that you do, but I mean... Everything that you're saying here now, which is, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, no one has to think it's really important. We don't have to know for sure what's on it. It just might be mundane, you know, might be mundane evidence that we want. And that coupled with your definition of excluded equals keeping out of possession of a person who wants it is a little bit concerning given the automatic stay provision, given the delays attendant upon an Article 62 appeal. Has the government considered that at all?
Your Honor, it may be an expansive reading, but first of all, to get to this case, to overrule True, the government would have to
overrule what?
Overrule True, Your Honor, in the functional effects test.
Functional effects test in True in the context of a different clause in Article 62.
Yes,
you agree,
Your
with
Honor.
That?
Nonetheless, yes. the court would first have to find that it had jurisdiction in order to make the determination and then to overrule that test, or to at least distinguish it. The court would have to do so. That's a matter of law.
Well, would you agree that in a case that is essentially done, it's been abated or it's been dismissed or the functional equivalent of being dismissed, that the speedy trial concerns or the issues of fairness to an appellant aren't nearly as important as they are in an interlocutory appeal such as this case presents?
Those constitutional concerns, Your Honor, are absolutely, they are paramount, but so too is the right of the people to every man's evidence. And in this case, that's what we are seeking. We contend that we have a legal right to it, and that the judge erred when he arbitrarily made that determination that it was cumulative without reviewing it. If there are no further questions, I submit the case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we thank counsel for the parties to the three proceedings before us for your participation today, for your indulging the court in questions that went beyond 20 minutes aside, and for your contributions to our decision. The case is now submitted. Thank you very much. The court will be adjourned.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.